This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Doesn't everybody love being on a boat?
Welcome to the gallows.
This is Jake. With me, as always, my co-host Adam.
Yo.
We will get started tonight, as always, with our public service announcement.
Absolutely. Visit us at thegallowspodcast.com. From there, you can go to our Facebook, Twitter, and Patreon. Nope, I take that back. Patreon is gone. Apparently, I have to scratch that off my list here. You can also visit us everywhere podcasts are found. If you have any questions, comments, or case ideas, please email us at thegallowspod@gmail.com.
Fantastic. We also want to give a special thank you to all of our listeners out there. We just hit another milestone this past week. We just hit our 7,000th download on Buzzsprout. So
yes.
That's pretty exciting stuff. We're going to continue to try to not put ads and stuff on the show and keep plowing forward. So do us a favor. Keep listening. Keep sharing. Keep subscribing. And we'll keep trying to put as much ad-free content out as possible for you.
And if I had an applause soundbite, I would have played it. So I'm going to have to add one to the board here.
There you go.
Because when we hit 10,000, I'm going to play it.
Yes.
Which will just be, in a few weeks. So
yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, we might be due for a little bit of merch at that point, huh? You know?
Well.
Get a little 10,000 merch out there
Little drawing.
Yes.
Drawing for somebody.
Absolutely. So before we get into tonight's story, just a little bit about what's going on in the world of executions. We had Lisa Montgomery, who was scheduled to die on 12/8.
Lisa.
She is the one that she actually murdered a pregnant lady and stole her baby.
That's disgusting.
She is scheduled to be the first woman executed by the federal government since 1950. And she actually had her case postponed slightly. Both of her lawyers had COVID. So they had claimed that they had lost valuable time in putting her last rites and stuff together to where they are going to get this pushed out. Now, not to be outdone... The Department of Justice has said, okay, fair enough. We're going to move it to January the 15th. So 5 days before the next inauguration. At that point in time, there are a lot of people that expect federal executions to be taken back off of the board for the next 4 years at least. So they're doing what they can to get things done ahead of time.
Hurry up.
Right. So Lisa is back on for 115. As of about an hour ago, unless there's news that we have not seen prior to the show, we had another federal execution that just happened in the last couple of hours.
I thought I saw the lights flicker.
Yeah, it was Brandon Bernard. He was one of the two people that were involved in the pastor murders in Texas. So his counterpart, Chris Villalba, was actually executed back in September. There were a lot of people advocating for this one to be vacated or to at least be transferred to a life sentence. It's a hard call to make. He was clearly there. He was clearly involved with it. His level of involvement is a real question. There's been a lot of speculation about this. This is a case that we're probably going to highlight later on when we get into a little bit more of some of the justice, not justice cases. It's a hard one for me. I don't want to get too deep into it, but if you want to do any research on it, again, that's Brandon Bernard. Not to slow the train down, tomorrow afternoon we have Alfred Bourgeois.
Bourgeois.
This complete POS murdered his own 2.5-year-old daughter by bashing her head against the front of his truck for tipping over her training potty at the age of 2.5 years old. So, as much as people protest and there's things that they disagree with in the world of capital punishment, he has admitted that he's done it. It's not a secret that he's done it. He's obviously gone through his appeals process and tried to fight his death penalty. If anybody out there is in any 1% on board with capital punishment, this guy's your poster child. So not real sad about the fact that that's coming down the pipe tomorrow.
Yeah, they can get rid of him. The sooner the better.
Yeah, so we won't get into the rest of the names, but outside of Lisa, there are actually two more executions that are scheduled to happen between now and the inauguration. What does that mean? That means that we will have executed 15 federal prisoners out of the 54 that were on federal death row.
Hmm.
So it's been some trash taken out by the DOJ. I agree with what AG Barr said when he was asked recently about this. He said that the laws are in place with these punishments. If we ever get to a point where these are no longer the punishments, then they will no longer be carried out. So
right.
I think that's a good way to look at it, to be honest. It's the law that was put into place. We are a country of laws. So you got to follow through with them at some point instead of continuing to suck taxpayers' money for somebody to sit in a federal pen.
Yeah, and it's kind of like some of these states that have the death penalty, but they don't execute.
Right.
Really weird.
It really is weird. So that's all I have on the upcoming executions. We'll give you another update next time.
Okay.
On to tonight's story.
Episode 38.
38. So I apologize for any names that I butcher throughout the show tonight. There's a few that are a little bit challenging. I will try to get them phonetically correct to make sure that I'm doing justice to the people involved. So Ivelisse Berrios Bergeres was living her best life at the age of 20 in November of 1990. She had recently married her high school sweetheart, and she was actually promoted to the assistant manager at the sporting goods store that she worked at inside the Sawgrass Mills Mall in Coral Springs, Florida. So, not too bad. You just got married. You got a promotion. You're 20 years old.
Life is good.
Life should be going pretty good, right? Well, she was known for being very much somebody that's on time, doesn't really go a lot out of her way. So, she should have arrived home from work that night right about 8 p.m. Well, given a little bit of time for traffic and stuff, her husband had gotten home just a little bit before that himself. But by 9 o'clock, he's like, she should probably be home by now. You know, and this is the pre-cell phone era. So instead of sounding the alarms, he goes in. He knows the exact route that she takes for work. So he thought, you know, she's got a 1985 Tempo. It does break down a little bit from time to time. So maybe she broke down. So he decides he's going to take the route, you know, from their house to the mall, see if he can find a broke down along the way someplace. He gets all the way to the parking lot, goes back to where the employee parking is, and he sees her car still sitting there. So he goes up to see if maybe she's sitting in it or something, and he notices that the two driver's side tires have both been slashed, and Ivelisse is nowhere to be found. So he goes to the payphone that's in the parking lot, and he immediately calls the police to report her missing. Police put out her description immediately. 5'2", dark hair, dark eyes, dark skin complexion, and extremely fit. That's a description, but that could be a lot of people.
Sure, that's very narrow.
Right. Well, at about 1 a.m., the police get a call from two men that were actually dropping off some bills at a public mailbox that when they pulled up to the mailbox, they could see there was a partially nude body that was underneath the mailbox. Right. Police arrive on scene, and they find that she's been bound with duct tape on her hands and her feet, both behind her back, and that she was obviously dead. And then they also found a piece of duct tape that was, like, wrapped around her hair for some reason. They didn't really come up with a reason why they felt that was the case.
That's weird. Like a standard mailbox? Like,
yes.
So she just shoved underneath it.
Yeah, like the big blue mailboxes that you see in town? Yeah. So they figure out very quickly that this is Ivelisse, and they look at her husband. He was at work literally right up until the time that she wasn't. They were able to rule out very quickly through phone records and a few things like that, that he was not any kind of shape or form involved in this. Well, they had an autopsy that was done, and it showed that she had been raped and strangled. And there was some semen that was actually taken from the autopsy. forensics aren't what they were in 1990 that they are today, but it was something that they were already in the practice of back then, which I was kind of surprised to hear that, because I don't know when exactly we started this practice, but I feel like the earlier the better with today's technology. You know, any of these cases that they were smart enough to pull this from, good job.
Well, in some of those early years of DNA, it wasn't as reputable.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah. But barely known at this point in time, in 1990. So the story makes the local news, you know, and they start looking to see if anybody knows anything, you know, anything like that. It actually, there's a series of articles that run in the local paper about it. But after a couple of weeks, literally 3-4 weeks, there's no leads, nothing credible that's going on, and the case goes cold for like 25 years. Well, about a year before Evelise was murdered, Joan Rogers, who's 36 at the time, she decides that she's going to take her daughters, Michelle, who's 17, and Christy on a vacation to Florida. This is going to be the first time that the three of them had ever left their farm in Wilkeshire, Ohio, and actually left the state of Ohio for a vacation. So that's a big deal. You know, you always remember the first time that you leave your home state, right?
Sure.
So Joan's husband and the girl's dad, Hal, he actually stays behind to work on their 200-acre farm. He says, I just can't leave the farm. You know, you guys go ahead and go. So they headed for Orlando on the 26th of May in 1989. Like I said, this is the year prior, right? So they get down there. They spend 2 full days at Disney. They're staying at a Disney resort. They go spend an entire day at SeaWorld and then a day at Silver Springs, right? Just another park that's down there. So after they had 4 days down there, they get up on the morning of June 1st and they head for Tampa Bay. What the girls didn't know is that their mom, Joan, had actually made a reservation for them at the Days Inn up there because she had one more surprise for them on the way home. The older daughter, Michelle, had always wanted to go to Busch Gardens. You know, she's from Ohio. She's been to Cedar Point, had always heard from her friends that had gone down south how much fun Busch Gardens was. So she decides she's going to surprise them one more night down there, and then they were going to go ahead and come on home the next day, right?
Yep.
Well, they're on the way up to Tampa. Again, 1990. I mean, this is 1989 at this point. You know, you got the map, and that's about it. There's no MapQuest. There's no Google. You know what I mean? Like, you got what you got to get you where you're going.
Wonder if the GPSs were out by then. They might have been.
No, they weren't. There were no TomToms or nothing like that yet.
You don't think?
No, that was really late 90s, right about 2000, when I think that those really started getting out to the masses.
Okay.
So she's driving, and she kind of has an idea that she's getting close, but she doesn't know exactly where she's at. So she just gets off at an exit, like I think just about all people would do, and she goes to a gas station. Well, she walks inside this gas station. There's one person working, which how often do we see that being the case? Always. And there's like 7 people in line. So she's like, well, I'm just going to go outside and see if there's any locals around here. So she goes outside, talks to some people, and bam, she's got directions. She's good to go. So they get to the hotel, and they get all checked in, and she calls her husband Hal to let all, because he had known that they were going to go to Busch Gardens the next day. So she starts telling him that, yeah, you know, it was a really bad line and that there was a real nice gentleman. Said he was probably about 40 years old, you know, right about her age. Said that he gave her directions exactly where to go, and then he noticed that she had an Ohio license plate. And he's like, you know, just chit-chatting with her, you know, being polite, and asked where they were from in Ohio. And she said, you know, we're from Wilshire. And he goes, oh, man, I got family in Van Wert. I know exactly what you're talking about, because Van Wert's only about 15 miles away. So they kind of struck up a conversation, and she also was telling Hal that the guy said, look, you know, I've got a sightseeing business down here. You know, like we go all around the Tampa Bay. You know, he's like, I'd be happy to take you guys out if you guys want to go out for a tour of the bay. So she said, you know what? It sounds like something fun for me and the girls to do. You know, we've got directions on where how to get down to the ramp and stuff. So we're going to go that route. Well, 3 days later, on June the 4th, there are 2 men that are fishing on the north shore of the Tampa Bay. And they come across a decomposing body. And they radio it into the Coast Guard. Within an hour, and within about 2.5 total miles, they find 3 total bodies.
And uh-oh.
It takes more than 3 days to get all the information that they need. But the manager from the Days Inn actually ends up calling the police and said, hey, you know, these people checked in like a week ago. They never really came back. They didn't take any of their stuff. Like, there's all kinds of personal belongings still in the room. So police go to the room. They gather up some of the stuff. They're actually able to make connections between the swimsuits that they were wearing with pictures that they had from earlier in the trip to figure out that the 3 deceased people were, in fact, Joan, Michelle, and Christy. So Hal, the husband, he had actually called Tampa police on 6-2 to say that he hadn't heard from Joan after she was supposed to go out on this evening cruise, and that he wanted to report her and her daughters missing. Well, then they notify him on 6-8 that their bodies have been found, and they find that he acts really, really strange. There is little to no emotion in the way that he talks. He asks how they died. He asks if they could see him. And police immediately, like, their ears prick up. It's like no tears, like, nothing distraught. Like, you know, why hadn't you gone on vacation with your wife and your two teenage daughters that had never been out of the state before? You know, why aren't you distraught about any of these deaths, right?
Yeah.
Well, the FBI starts to obviously investigate. I mean, you always start with the husband, right? So they start to investigate, and they start to find some things that are a little bit out of place that kind of show that the Rogers household really isn't one of those down-home country family farming households that you would expect.
Surprise, surprise.
See, the year prior, in 1998, Hal's brother, John, had actually been arrested on multiple counts of rape. There were four victims, one of which was Michelle, John's daughter. So it turns out that Uncle John had begun raping her when she was 14 on the family farm.
Ugh.
Now, when John got taken to jail for this, Hal promised his mom that he was going to bail him out. Nothing was proven, that nobody was talking. None of the victims had apparently said anything yet to this point, to where the family, at least part of the family, thinks that it's a big witch hunt, right? Well, to make matters worse, Hal goes ahead and he moves John back onto the property, but he moves him down to a house that's on the other end of the property, but he's still a couple hundred acres away from the family, right? Well, this doesn't help the relationship between Hal and Joan, which had already been icy for years. There was tons of rumors about her having multiple affairs, and this is something that actually kicks up when this happens. You know, apparently there's a couple different people in town that she's having affairs with at this point in time. Well, this brings us to Christmas of 1998, right? So it's been almost a year since the rape allegations and stuff happened. And Hal and Joan sit down and they reconcile everything, you know? And Joan, who'd been working at another company at this point in time, she decides to come back and start working on the farm again. And things were supposed to be getting better. But people from the town would even say later, you know, that, yeah, they were back together, but you never saw them anywhere together. They didn't go to church together. You know, she did the shopping. He'd do his running around. Just one of those couples that you never saw together, right? Well, about a month before the trip to Florida happens, Uncle John starts serving his 7 to 25 year sentence, right? So once again, there's turmoil in the family because Hal and John's mom shows up and starts chastising Joan about the whole thing. You know, that if Michelle hadn't testified against him, that none of the other stuff would have stuck in court, and that it's their fault that Uncle John's in jail. Right?
The guy that did the raping.
Exactly. Hal steps in, though, finally to defend his wife and daughters. And he says, you know what, Mom? I'm going to cut ties with you. If you can't, after all of this and all the trials and everything, if you can't get on board with what actually happened to your granddaughter, I don't have no room for you.
Amen.
But, true to form, he also came back at Joan and he said, you know what? I just cut my mom out of my life. If you hadn't been running around being a whore this entire time, John never would have had access to Michelle while I'm out there busting my ass working. So part of this has to fall on you too.
Yep.
Well, Joan obviously doesn't take that well. You know, she's like, you're not going to criticize me in my life when I am who I am because of the way you treat me. And I didn't give anybody permission to rape our daughter. Right. So the couple is really back at it again. Well, a couple weeks go by to where they really don't speak much to each other. Joan comes home from the barn the one day, and her and Hal sit down, and they literally talk all night. They get everything aired out. Everybody's on the same page. It's time to cut John and Mom out of the life for good and move on together as a family. And they described that the next 2 weeks were fantastic, right? Leading right up to the trip. So he apologized with everything, you know, and she said, you know what? I'm going to take the girls on this trip. She's like, you've got plenty of help here around the farm. Take a couple days for yourself, you know, don't work yourself to death while we're gone. Go enjoy a few things, you know, enjoy your hobbies out in the garage. He enjoyed working on cars, doing some of that kind of stuff. Just go do that kind of stuff. So the family kind of all got a vacation, right? When it seemed like they all needed it, right? Well, even with the problems in the family and the marriage, the police actually finally removed Hal from the potential suspect list in October of 1990. This was 5 months after his wife and daughters were murdered. So it takes 5 months to clear him in all this. They had a bunch of evidence based on transactions that he had had at different businesses and stuff like that, that he had never left the state of Ohio. They didn't show any large amounts of money that had been taken out of any banks or anything that it would show that he was involved in like a murder for hire or anything like that. So now it's time for the police. Okay, they've done their due diligence on him, and they've kind of been looking other directions, but now they need to start focusing all their efforts on other things, right? So they start going back through the boat tour, right? Exactly what was going on. And Joan had actually told Hal, when they were on the phone, that this guy's name was Dave Posno, right? So trying to give her husband the information, I think that's a smart thing to do if you're going to go out something like that. At least you're letting them know who you're with and what's going on. Well, this name didn't mean much to investigators to start with until they found that there was another report from May the 14th of 1989. So this is about 2 weeks before the murders end up happening. So what happened on May 14th? There's two Canadian women named Blair and Barbara that were on holiday in Tampa, and they had ran into a man named Dave Posner, right? So he just switched the N and the S. So instead of Ponser, it was Posner, right? Very creative. He said that he was an aluminum siding contractor that was on vacation, and he asked him if they'd like to go on a boat tour. He said, you know, I'm from the area. I know it really well. I used to take tours all the time. If you guys are interested, I'll kind of take you out. Well, Blair said, yeah, I would love to go, you know, but Barbara was like, I don't like water. I really don't like strangers, you know? So she gets all the way down to the dock and she's like, yeah, I'm just going to go back to the room. So Blair goes out and they have a great time and they actually see all kinds of stuff. And she gets back to the dock and says, hey, you know, he said, the evening time's the best. He's like, you saw it during the day, but if you want to come back for the evening, he's like, that's when you're going to get the pictures that you're going to want to take home, you know? So she goes back to the room and talking to Barbara, and she said, yeah, come on. You know, she's like, this guy's really, really nice. It's a nice boat. She's like, it's perfect out there. She's like, you don't have nothing to worry about. And she said, you know what? It's not my thing. I'll just wait for you back here and we'll go to dinner or whatever when you get back. So Blair said, well, I'm going to get this trip for free twice. I'm going. So she gets out on the open water with David, and this time he forces himself on her, and she starts to fight back, and she says, you know, I'm a virgin. Like, please don't do this. So he leans in and he tells her, he goes, you know what? I'm going to take your virginity, but I'm going to let you keep your life. And then he proceeds to rape her. After the rape's over, he gives her a blanket and she's kind of curled up on the boat. And he's kind of stammering, talking back and forth to himself, you know, whether or not he should kill her, what he should do. He's not real sure. And she very pleasantly reminds, she's like, look, my friend's waiting for me back there. She's like, she knows who you are. She knows what your boat looks like, where it's docked. She's like, if I don't come back, she's going to go to the authorities. She doesn't know anybody else down here. So he ends up driving right up to the dock, tells her to get off, and she takes off and he speeds away, just gone. Well, she goes straight to the police to report the rape and give a physical description of this guy. 5'10", 200 pounds, dark complected, sandy hair with blotch marks on his face, like he had bad acne when he was a kid. She also sits down with a sketch artist to put a composite together of the whole thing. So they take her directly from the police station to the hospital, and they perform a rape kit, right? So they put this warrant out for Dave Posner, but there's no Dave Posner anywhere. They can't find him in any records anywhere in Tampa.
Because he's clever.
Because it ain't a real name, right? But it just so happens that one of the investigators that took Blair's story was also an investigator on the Rogers case. Now, you're talking a department of about 75 agents here. So the odds that you're going to get one person that's working on both of these, I mean, the Rogers case is a big case because you have three women that are killed. But still to have that crossover, and they were like, hold on a minute, let's take a look at this. So he reaches out to Blair in Canada to get some information from her. They start to believe that they're on the right track here, right? So they start going through all the stuff that's in the hotel room, and they're actually able to, through Hal, they're able to locate her car as well. That's actually down near the dock where they had gotten onto the boat. Inside of her car, they find a flyer for boat tours, but it's for a different company, a company that's literally miles down the coast. And there were handwritten directions on there, along with Joan's handwriting that had written a phone number down. Right? So you have two different sets of handwriting that are on here. And then they take this and they find a full palm print that does not match Joan. Right? So police start working every lead that they can possibly find, dead ends left and right. It gets to 1992. So it's been a little over 2 years since these murders, right? They have no suspects. All they have is the sketch, the handwriting, and a palm print. Well, they're not going to give the palm print to the public. but they decide, you know, let's try something a little bit different. They actually take up billboards around the city of Tampa. They put the actual handwriting, what it looks like, along with the sketch. And it says, if you recognize this man or this handwriting, you might know who killed the Rogers family. This was not done back then. I mean, this is a big thing that they actually, I mean, these aren't like the digital ones that you see now that you can put anything new on. These are actually full blown. They actually took out 15 of these around the city, right?
Man, that's a lot.
Right. Well, within a few days of the billboards going up, investigators get a call from a woman. She says, I know exactly who this is. His name's Oba Chandler. She also explains that she called this tip in 1989 when she saw the sketch on the news. Police were baffled. They're like, wait, you called this in before? Then why don't we already have this guy? Well, they start looking. They find out that she really did call it in. They had this lady's police report from when she had called this in. They actually sent two officers to the house to check this out. When they got there, the landlord was actually there and said, no, this family moved out like a week ago. Like, they're gone. There's nobody here. We'd come to find out later that this family had moved to Texas. I mean, had moved to California, right? So when nothing checked out, they had no forwarding address. There were so many things that were going on with the case. I mean, over 1,500 leads had come in at that point in time. They didn't have time to keep tracking this one down, wow, right?
That's crazy.
Right. So while they're investigating this, you know, they feel a lot more comfortable now that this is going to be who they're looking for. They get a call from another woman that says she knows the handwriting right off the bat, that a guy had come in and that he was giving her an estimate on getting some tin work done on her house. And she knew as soon as she saw that was a handwriting that she had on the estimate. So police go meet with her. They get the paper from her. Sure as heck, right there's Oba's name. Right there is everything that they need. So they pick him up at his house on November the 7th, and they bring him in for questioning. Well, first thing they do is they have him sign a paper saying that, you know, he's given his statement voluntarily. Well, what do you think they did?
They were looking at the handwriting.
Well, not just the handwriting. They wanted that palm print.
Oh, okay.
So they take it immediately from the room straight down to forensics. Now, forensics don't move as fast as people want it to, right? So they've got him for about 24 hours. Now, he did admit that he had introduced himself by his pseudonym. Not an alias, a pseudonym, because a pseudonym doesn't mean anything, right? To Joan, and that he had given her directions. That's why Joan knew his name. But that he had never seen her after that. They never showed up to his boat. So he wasn't sure who he could have possibly gone out with, right? And other than the news, he had never seen them at any other point in time. Again, they're not really buying this, but they also don't have any proof yet.
Exactly. I mean, at some point, you have to have circumstantial evidence.
Right. So with little other than the few identifications that people thought, you know, that this might be the guy, they thought, well, we're going to end up having to let this guy loose and keep working on this. Well, they ran his name through the system. Lo and behold, there's a warrant out for his arrest. You see, this genius, when he had come back to Florida from his California year-long vacation to try to get away from the heat that was going on from the murders, he had concocted a scheme with his current wife, Barbara, to knock off a jewelry truck. They stole $700,000 worth of jewelry.
What?
How does one steal $700,000 worth of jewelry?
You'd think it would be like in five duffel bags.
Right. So this genius gets all this stuff back home, and he finds a torch. Like, you know how, like, if you're going to repair a ring, you know how they use, like, an actual, like, a little torch for that? He takes a whole bunch of gold rings, like piles. It was reported it took him 2 days to do this, and melts them into, like, this big blob of gold. Just no longer rings. You know, it's just a big glob. Well, he takes it down to a pawn shop, sells it for $9,500. The pawn shop owner turns around and says, you know what? There ain't no way that this is legal. Like, because you don't ever see this come in like this. Turn it into the authorities. That's how his name gets into the system to where they're looking for him, right? So on November the 7th, they get him booked in for grand theft. So now they've got a little bit of time. Early on the morning of the 10th, they get a positive match on the palm print, and Oba is indicted on 3 counts of murder.
Whoopsie.
Once the palm print matches. The other thing that they decide to do is they fly Blair in from Canada. She comes in, sees the lineup, 2 seconds, picks him out of the lineup, just like that. Able to nail this guy red-handed. So they know they've got their guy.
You got some splaining to do, Lucy.
Right. So police begin to find a mountain of inconsistencies as he starts going through his story. They know that it's going to be a ton of BS, but they've also got him basically dead to rights, right? So they end up proving a bunch of this stuff as out-and-out lies. He tries to say, you know, no, this is all a big mistake. I was actually out fishing alone that night that the women were murdered. I didn't have anything to do with it, and my boat broke down. He said that he called the Coast Guard and that they were unable to help because they were busy with other things. So he decided to fix his gas leak with duct tape because he had a gas line that broke, apparently. Well, an expert testified in court that duct tape A would not have held up to the pressure of this particular type of hydraulic line, and that the gas itself that's used in a boat would have actually eaten through the adhesive of the duct tape. So there's no way he'd have been able to use it to get back. His wife at the time, Barbara, also testifies that she received 3 calls from him while he was on the water and that he never called the Coast Guard. He basically called her and said, hey, I'm on really good fishing. I'm not coming home yet. Hey, I'm still on really good fishing. I'm not coming home yet. So he's lying to his wife about where he's at the time, right? And she also is like, oh, by the way, he basically forced me at gunpoint to do the jewelry heist, so I'm going to go ahead and take immunity for that in exchange for my testimony. We cool? Yep, we're good. So she got nothing for being part of the jewelry heist, which I thought was interesting in itself. So police had found out that Oba was actually from Cincinnati. He had been in trouble off and on since he was 18 years old. At this point in time, he's 45 when he's finally convicted of all this. He has 13 kids with 12 different women, and he had done,
holy shit.
And prior to all of this, he had done 3 stretches in prison. Now, they also find out that his oldest daughter, oldest of the 13, Crystal, is the only child that he stays in really good contact with, right? And he had actually been staying with her for a while in between California and Florida. Well, she knew that her dad was in trouble. You know, they contacted her after he was arrested because they knew that he had been in Ohio, and they're like, look, if you don't tell us what you know, you're going to be up shit creek too. So she says, you know what? If you give me immunity, I will testify 100% against my dad, everything I know. And he told me everything. So she decides to give her testimony. And the one police officer that investigator said that it's the most chilling interview he's ever had, that she was basically emotionless as she told the story. Her father confessed to all 3 murders to her in explicit detail. He said that Joan and the girls had arrived somewhere around 5 o'clock and they head out. Once they were a couple miles from shore, he tied all 3 of them up with duct tape, hands behind their back, and then their feet bound as well. He then raped Michelle, which was the oldest of the 2 daughters, in front of the mom and the sister right there on the boat. After he was done raping her, he tied a nylon rope around her neck that was woven through 2 cinder blocks and threw the cinder blocks overboard.
While she was alive.
Dragging her straight to the bottom.
Good God.
He then raped Joan in front of Christy and repeated the same process of tying 2 cinder blocks to her neck and throwing the cinder blocks overboard. At this point, he had already raped and killed 2 women. And with Christy being 14, he apparently was a little bit conflicted on what to do. So he took a couple laps around the bay, took a couple of hours. By then, he had regained his nerve and he raped her as well. And then proceeded to put a singular block around her neck. She begged for her life while he was doing this. And he said, I don't care if you tell or not, it's too late for you. And he threw the cinder block overboard. And obviously she followed him behind it. The coroner would later explain in court that the only reason that they were found is because he didn't use enough cinder blocks. That through the decomposition process, the body actually produces tissue gas, which is what made them rise to the surface. And that the actual flesh around their necks had given way to where that's where the cinder blocks would eventually come off. And that's why they were able to be found floating. While this testimony is given in court, Oba just sits there and he's actually staring at multiple female jurors, grinning, winking, and at one point he licked his lips to where the judge had to basically threaten him with contempt if he did it again. I mean, how sick is this?
This guy is full of himself and doesn't believe there's any consequences for his actions.
Well, there were. In the end, it took less than 2 hours of deliberation to convict him. And instead of postponing the deliberation on what to do with him, the judge imposed the death sentences immediately. There was no hesitation. It's something that apparently they're allowed to do. Most of the time they have a separate hearing for it. They said, no, we're going to roll on 2 right here. Yeah. So this brings us to November the 15th of 2011, the execution date. In the nearly 18 years that Oba is on death row, he receives not a singular visitor. On the eve of the execution, he doesn't want to see any clergy, lawyers, or friends. which who wants to go see this guy at this point anyway?
It was probably mutual.
Right? At 10 a.m., he receives his last requested meal of 2 salami sandwiches and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with ice cream and iced tea.
That's weird. I mean, I like salami sandwiches, but that's not my last meal.
No. Once they get him strapped into the gurney, it takes almost an hour to find a suitable vein. They estimate that they had to stick him about 50 times before they were able to finally find one in his leg.
How many of these guys do you think they dehydrate themselves on purpose?
I don't know, but I would probably dehydrate it myself if I was a state for a monster like this. So the curtains open, and he's asked if he has any final words. And at this point, he can't even muster a word out, which is a far cry from where this guy was at a couple months before, where they had done an interview with him, you know, for one of these like Forensic Files shows. And he said his final words were going to be, you guys can kiss my rosy red ass. So little bit different category when you're actually facing down death's door here. So the 3-drug cocktail gets pushed at 4:08, and it takes 17 minutes before he's officially declared dead at 4:25. Hal Rogers, the husband and father, attended the execution and sat there completely stoic, fixated on Oba the entire time. When it was over, he stood up, he shook the prosecutor's hand and just said thank you and walked out. He gave no statement. He went back to his farm, and to this day, he does not speak to anybody about this. He will not grant an interview or nothing. A couple cliff notes. In 2014, the Florida Bureau of Investigation announced that through DNA evidence that they had obtained through the other crimes, they were able to link Obi unquestionably to the death of Ivelisse. And so that is at least 4 right there.
That was the one under the mailbox, right?
Yes. They also were able to link him to a 1982 rape and murder in the same area. And they have gone through multiple case files, and they believe that he may be responsible for up to 30 murders in the Tampa area in a 20-year period.
Holy smokes.
So there is a lot of hope. You can find a lot about this guy online to read about it. There are groups that are trying to put genetic profiles and stuff together to try to see how much they can trace to see what they can put back on this guy. I'm sure that when and if they end up bringing this out, they're going to try to get as many of them out together at one time as humanly possible. Couple questions here. I understand that the late 80s, early 90s, it's a different time. But could you even imagine getting on a boat with a stranger? Whether it's you by yourself, like Blair from Canada, or you and your two daughters that are from 5 states away. I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around what would be the mentality of getting on this boat with this guy.
Well, he's obviously not like with a company. That's what I'm like. Normally, you would look for some. I mean, unless you're looking for the cheap way out.
Yeah.
You would normally look for like there's a business. Oh, they give boat tours. Let's go check them out.
Right.
But a personal guy that just like.
And it's not somebody you know. It's not like somebody that you knew that lived down there and you're like, hey, you know.
It's just Joe Schmo offering right. a boat tour.
Yeah. I don't know.
As a woman by myself
mm-hmm.
or a. woman with kids, I would be like, fuck no.
Right. That's how I feel about it. It's surprising to me that anybody would do this. I would think that this would happen a lot less today
right.
than maybe it would have 30 years ago. I don't know.
I mean, I guess it's not as crazy to think that it happened in this time period. But
yeah.
I think now we're really more hypersensitive.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm wrestling with on this case is his oldest daughter, Crystal, that he had confessed this to, right? She has basically gone mute. She does not talk about it anymore. She will not grant an interview, the same type thing. There are a lot of people that speculate that she knows more about other things that her dad would have confided in her.
Sure.
If it ever comes out that from the time that he was staying with her until the time that he was actually apprehended, that he murdered anyone else in there, do you think that she should be facing some kind of harboring charges, aiding and abetting something? I mean, because if the day she found this out about her dad, she would have gone to the cops, somebody might still be alive because of it.
Sure. No, I mean, of course, if that's the case where a year prior or 6 months prior, she said, oh my God, he just told me this stuff. I got to go to the cops.
Yeah.
Like you said, then maybe these 3 are still alive.
Sure.
Who knows?
Do you think it was worth it for the state and for the family, for her to get full immunity just for telling the story when they really already have this guy I mean, he's going to be convicted even without her testimony.
Yeah, but her, I think her testimony is the nail in the coffin.
Yeah. So you think it was worth it?
I mean, probably. I mean, she didn't do the murders.
Yeah.
Now, if it comes out, like you said, where she knew more about other ones,
mm-hmm.
yeah, then maybe we retract that.
Yeah. Another thing that, again, I know different times things happen. I know that there's only so much manpower. Yes, it's mentioned that there were 1,500 calls in for leads and stuff, but how do they not follow up again on this guy after he had moved? Like, how was this? I don't know. I mean, again, I don't remember 1990 from an adult perspective, right? I was like 11 in 1990. But how are you not following up on this guy if you think that he had something to do with a triple homicide? Yeah. Like, how is this not getting out to basically everywhere? Like, how many murders does it take to end up on the FBI's most wanted list, you know, or to where like the U.S. Marshals are looking for you? Like, I don't understand how it got to how it took 3 years to basically find this guy.
Yeah, it's very confusing. I mean, you got a lady that's saying, I know who this is. And they go to the house. Ah, he moved. Okay, he moved. Pip, pip.
Right.
No, I mean, you got to figure out who it is, where he went, and
yeah.
continue.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, when is moving your residence a get-out-of-jail-free card?
Right. I mean, I hope that with technology these days and that people are probably a little bit more trackable because the amount of information that's available on the internet and you have to register everything everywhere, hopefully these kind of things aren't happening as often.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're still happening, though.
Sure.
And as always, was justice served in this case?
Yes. And then some.
I think for sure. I think he's one of those people that no matter which side of the argument you're on, this guy is not serving a purpose anymore at this point in time. I am glad that they removed him from society to where this couldn't happen again.
Amen.
It's clear that he did suffer from some level of mental health issues.
Of course.
And as always on this show, we always advocate for you to make sure that you're taking care of your mental health. If you have a substance abuse problem, an abuse issue, something that you just can't handle, please pick up the phone and call 1-800-622-4357. Somebody on the other end of that phone will be there to help you.
Absolutely. So if you have bad thoughts about hurting yourself or others or just can't kick that substance abuse problem, please call the number.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Stay safe.